Welcome to the Manuscript Academy podcast,
brought to you by
a writer
and an agent
who both believe that education is key.
The beauty is the people you meet along the way,
and that community makes all the difference.
Here at the Manuscript Academy, you can learn the skills, make the connections, and have access to experts all from home.
I'm Julie Kingsley.
And I'm Jessica Sinsheimer.
Put down your pens, pause your word counts, and enjoy.
So thank you both so much for being here. We are always so happy to hear good news. Will you tell us how all of this happened and who you are and what you're working on and help our listeners be happy for you too?
I'll let Amy start. I'll let her narrate how she went about, you know, looking for an agent and what her journey was like.
Yeah, so I found Manuscript Academy through a colleague who I work with at Pandarus Literary Magazine. I had already listened to the podcast a couple of times, and I was familiar just from querying a project with the manuscript wish list. So I found Manuscript Academy, and it was after I had been querying this project for a little while, and I knew I needed to kind of redirect. And so I was searching to see, you know, what I was doing wrong, kind of. It just wasn't quite clicking together. I booked a session with Letitia, and she just connected. Well, I researched. I made sure that my project was something that she'd be interested in. I did kind of a longer session, and so I got to send a little bit of my proposal to Letitia, and she liked it, and she wanted to see my proposal, which was really great. But the project, it's a nonfiction narrative, historical, about a women's track team in 1960, and they're from Tennessee, which is where I'm from. And in 1960, eight women that were coached by the same coach from a historically Black college in Nashville, they went to the Olympics. They made the Olympic team together in Rome, and four of them came home with gold medals. And no one was expecting them to do anything. Women weren't encouraged to play sports at all in 1960, and they just blew everyone away. They became like the media darlings of the world. They were hanging out with Cassius Clay, who's later called Muhammad Ali, and like all the, you know, all the movie stars were over in Rome for the Olympics. And it was just kind of an amazing story of their success. And the success of that team, particularly in that year, what paved the way for Title IX. A lot of people believe that women would not have Title IX if it weren't for that team. I grew up knowing about the story because I'm from Nashville and my grandfather was a coach and all, but I feel like more people need to know about them. I think people need to know, you know, why you take your daughter to play soccer. They made it easier for all of us to do that.
It took women going to the Olympics for people to be like, maybe they should have some rights.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They had to win too. Not just going to the Olympics, they had to bring home gold medals. So, because they had gone to the Olympics the 4 years prior, a few of them had, and they didn't win the gold, and they had no resources. They had to sacrifice and give up everything to be able to do that and to train that hard. And people were telling them not to, that women shouldn't run, that it was bad for their bodies, they weren't going to be able to have children. So yeah, that was what people believed in 1960. It doesn't seem like that long ago for people to have that kind of a mentality, but they absolutely did.
Kind of like how they thought that women riding on trains would somehow make their uterus fly out of them at 40 miles an hour.
Yeah. They thought that running would do the same thing, that it would just make your uterus like fall out. Yeah.
When Amy first pitched it to me, I was deeply, deeply intrigued. And I immediately thought, wow, this could be something that could be turned into a television series or a docuseries. As an agent, one of my specialties is narrative nonfiction, whether it's historical or contemporary. And I do a lot of sports-themed projects as well. And so I just happened to know that there were some editors in the book publishing business that were expressly looking for female-centric, historical, narrative, nonfiction sports stories. The book that Amy has written does not come around very often. It's a very special book.
I love that. And I love that you just happened to know that that's what people were looking for. I guess not happen to know. That is, of course, part of the job. But do you happen to remember how you knew?
I think because of the racial tension that seems to be rampant once again in this country, especially with what happened, you know, with George Floyd and all the others, it sparked a new interest in historical stories, you know, from a different perspective.
Can you describe your working relationship? How is it going? Like, how do you guys communicate? Like, where are we with the project? I can't wait to hear more about this amazing story.
I think we clicked pretty quickly, you know, and when she sent me the proposal, that told me a lot about her in terms of her professionalism and her ability to craft a very intriguing story. I knew that if I didn't get to it fairly quickly, somebody else would beat me to the punch.
Yeah, from my side, I was really kind of blown away about how quickly everything went. I kind of thought it was going to be a process, and I was preparing for like, okay, now we're going to dig in. And Letitia's like, it's ready to go. Let's get this out. I mean, granted, I had worked really hard on the proposal. And so I was grateful that she said, it's ready. Let's send it out. Basically, I mean, you know, there were a few things. Then once we sent it out on submission, Letitia did a big blast. Then we got our first offer within a couple of weeks.
I knew it was a good thing. I just had to find that editor that wasn't going to procrastinate either.
When we first started just getting feedback from the editors, one thing I found that was so different from the querying process, the editors would almost always get back to Letitia and she would forward me their responses. And even when they said no, there were a lot of really nice no's.
There was a lot of nice no's.
I mean, I'm new to this process. And so I felt like the feedback was so educational and encouraging, even when it was a rejection, you know, hearing from a big five publisher that I have lovely writing made my day, even when they said no. No matter how long the process is, you're just waiting on pins and needles when you know something is out there. And so just getting any kind of, you know, I would see Letitia's name pop up in my email and I'm like, what happened? What's that?
That's the hardest part about this process is the wait. I tell my clients, look, if you're working on another project, the best thing is to let me do my work and my job. And then you go on and work on something else so that the wait doesn't seem so torturous.
I would say from everything we are hearing, it is clear, Amy, you wrote a brilliant proposal. No, it sounds like there are so many things here that are good indicators of that. It was fast. There were a lot of positive responses. Everything here sounds like you made this beautiful book proposal. How did you learn how to do that?
Well, I did a lot of research. I also tapped a lot of colleagues. I went to lots of workshops. I just studied up, and it was a little bit trial and error to find exactly the right way to do it, the right way that hit. And I was insecure about my platform because I didn't have a huge platform. And I know that nonfiction, that's really important. I kept being a little weak in with the marketing because that's the hard part, you know, like, and that's what the editors really want to see. I'm thinking about crafting a great story and they're thinking about who they're going to sell it to. And so the marketing part was always needing just a little bit more. And so I think finally we had it right, because I'm thinking, you know, anybody who's ever been an athlete before wants to read this story. And that's everybody. How do I quantify that? Everyone's going to want to read this story.
Letitia, what is your common denominator with all your clients?
The common denominator with all my clients is that I feel like they really have faith in me. It has to be a trust between each other. It has to be a two-way street. So I only work with people that I feel truly are willing to entrust their work to me. And then I have to trust them as well. So trust in each other is a common denominator. They have to have a very strong work ethic, because I have a very strong work ethic. When I'm asked, who is the client from hell for you? And I says, a client from hell for me is a client who does not have a sense of humor. You know, so it's just somebody that you feel comfortable with. And with Amy, I felt comfortable with. I felt like she had complete trust in me and I had complete trust in her. So trust is the common denominator.
I love that as a question to ask agents when you are on the call. What is your client from hell? That's a really interesting question.
It's somebody who doesn't have a sense of humor, because this business can be so brutal that you're going to need comic relief from time to time.
Yeah.
Amy, how has your life changed since you met Letitia?
Well, I mean, it's really great to, instead of saying I have this project I'm working on now, it's going to be published on January 1st. And so that's really exciting. In my mind, I didn't feel like I had a deal until I got an actual contract and it was all signed, sealed, and delivered. And Letitia says, no, it's not going to fall apart at this point. So get going. You have to start working. And I wanted to talk to the editor and see what he had to say before I got too far in one direction, you know, so it was taking a little while to get started. And then all of a sudden having to have the book done on a pretty short deadline was a little busy. And then, you know, once I turned it in though, now I'm learning new things about the marketing side of things and just kind of planning strategies. So I feel like it's changed just every new step is teaching me a new process that I'm having to learn. And so I just kind of always have to be on my toes a little bit.
And it'll be interesting to see what comes next. We're at the point where usually the time is going to be for me to start trying to option the book for film and television rights. All of my clients retain those rights because the publisher usually is willing to let the authors keep that right. So I definitely see this as a very strong possibility that it will get, you know, in time optioned for film and television. And then Amy does have a writer, a next option work clause.
Yeah, I have been thinking about what might come next, but it's hard to pull away my focus. I do think about, well, the Tiger Bells keep going and they went through all of the Olympic eras. And so I don't know, there could be more. But I mean, when you dangle the idea of someone TV rights, what writer is not going to get excited about that?
Well, you know, and that is a long process.
Possibility.
It is a long process, you know, but I think right now it's important to make this book a success. And it's a lot of, you know, writing the book is the easy part sometimes, the publicity and marketing, because I've always felt that even though you do have a good publisher in your corner, really the life of the book really depends on the author. This book has the ability, I think, to have a very long shelf life.
You know, it's funny because my marketing brain is always going crazy. And I was like, this is like Boy in the Boat, but girls in the Olympics. Yeah. Like, and since I don't know this story, I'm dying to just dive in. But I think there's such amazing opportunities as well. You have an adult book, but also making this into the, you know, middle grade mm-hmm. nonfiction library space, I think is really interesting. And I think that when we're looking at women's empowerment with sports, that it's just a slam dunk when it comes to television or film. So like there's going to be so much marketing opportunities with this book. It's really exciting.
I think this book could really resonate with a lot of young women today.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, what are the things that, was it Wilma? Which one of the girls was already a teenage mom? She had already had a baby.
Oh, Rudolph was, yeah.
Wilma, right. She had a baby and had to drop out of high school, right? And she went back. So to do that in the 60s, that took a lot of grit. That took a lot of courage. I think it's just all four women, I think, are great examples. And I think that a lot of young women could really their story could resonate with a lot of young women today.
Absolutely. They had to struggle with so many of the same things that women are struggling with, especially young women are struggling with today. But in 1960 in Tennessee, they had even more. And so it's kind of a good reminder of we have so many challenges right now, but we've come a long way still. I feel like it's just really good to look back and see what progress we have made and also, you know, mm-hmm. sympathize with the generation that came before and they made things just a little bit easier for us, but we know we have so much further to go. And so you sympathize with their struggle. You really can feel it in a real way.
And I think an aspect of their story that would really lend itself to really entertaining television is that it's also kind of pop culture in a way, because these girls were hanging out with the celebrities of their time.
And they were just a lot of fun. I mean, because the narrative nonfiction is kind of tricky. There's just a hard balance between making it kind of a journalistic and a little bit more dry versus too creative, where you're putting yourself into the story too much. And so when I finally hit the right balance, it was them telling their stories in their own language. It's really quote heavy, so quote heavy, almost like you're reading a documentary, because they are the best storytellers. they have their language and the way that they're always laughing while they're telling stories. And they tell, you know, they're teenagers. So they were getting in trouble. They were sneaking out of the dorm and putting, like, you know, they put a brick in the dorm door so they could sneak out back and get back in. And but they had all these strict rules. So the coach, one night, he heard that they were trying to sneak out and he drove his car to the back of the dorm. And when they were trying to get down the fire escape, he flashed the lights on the fire escape and they all froze and then ran back up the fire escape. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those stories of them telling, or when they met Cassius Clay for the first time and they just all laughed when they talked about him. He hadn't won anything yet and they thought he was just a braggadocious young kid who was just all full of hot air, and they saw him finally start winning, and then it was, you know, so all the ways that they tell all these really fun stories, it's more than just running, you know, it's more, but there's that too. There's where they had to run till their feet bled, and at their school they didn't have a track that went all the way around. So they had to run at the neighboring school that didn't have elite athletes, but they had more funding. And so for the boys team, they had this beautiful track. And so the Tiger Bells would get to go run on another track, but they didn't have it at their own school. They didn't have the facilities that they needed. It's kind of like blood, sweat, and tears, and then lots of laughter and lots of fun. And I think the overriding theme of the book that I kept coming back to is how much they were a family and they were a sisterhood, and how much they loved their coach and his wife and their daughter, the coach's daughter, who I got to know really well. They felt like they were sisters with her. They would babysit her when she was little. And it's just that closeness, and that makes you realize that's what you need to be able to achieve that level of success. You need a really strong support system. You need discipline, and you need really that grit, you know, that thing that's going to make you push the extra mile. But the sisterhood that they have, I think, was probably the most compelling thing that I learned out of the research.
I can't help but note the parallel between you talking about, you know, your characters, your amazing, this amazing group of women, and the women of publishing, you know, that it takes all those things. It's grit, it's the team, it's the energy, it's the sisterhood, it's the supporting each other that makes a great book, you know?
Yeah, it's a lot of, I mean, the lessons that we can all learn about how to support each other in our lives, and the collaboration of, you know, between Letitia and me, and the whole editing process now, and even the marketing, you know, I've now met the publicist that I'm working with, and that's another collaboration. And Letitia's right, you have to have that trust. You have to be able to believe the experts, know what they're doing, they're going to guide you through, and everybody has the ultimate goal of having a story they believe in, reach the most people that it can, or the people who really want to find it should be able to. So.
And at the end of the day, it's an underdog story, because these women were underdogs. They faced so many, you know, insurmountable obstacles, but together, their strength was their togetherness, their sisterhood. And so if one of them failed, they all failed. If one of them succeeded, they all succeeded. They were nine bodies, but they were really one vessel.
I mean, I think books are sometimes more than, you know, running. And it sounds like you guys have really accomplished that.
Amy, you wouldn't happen to have your pitch letter handy that you could read to our listeners, would you?
Oh my gosh, my first query.
It was really good. It was really good.
So thank you for taking the time to review a few pages of my proposal for a nonfiction historical narrative. With your interest in uncovering unknown historical stories, I hope you might find it interesting. The year is 1960, and the host city is Rome. It is the moment when the world was forced to sit up and acknowledge that women can run. The Tiger Bells is the story of how eight women from Tennessee State University and HBCU in Nashville made it to the Olympics, and four of them came home with gold medals. It was the first and only time in history such a feat had been accomplished from a single school. One of those runners, Wilma Rudolph, earned worldwide acclaim for her record-setting victory. But the extraordinary story of the entire team is not widely told. Tiger Bells tells of the grit, determination, and ultimate triumph of an extraordinary group of women who, over the course of one summer, learned to lean on each other to reach their goals despite harrowing circumstances. Along their journey to Rome, the women see their friends arrested for protesting with John Lewis in Nashville, have to fight off racist reporters and unfair media, spend evenings dancing to Motown tunes with Cassius Clay, explore the streets of Rome, and reach out their hands for Olympic gold. For recent releases like Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the Women's National Football League by Brittany De La Cretaz and Lindsay D'Arcangelo, and One Goal by Amy Bass, which has recently been optioned by Netflix, to older titles that had continuous cultural impact, such as Hidden Figures by Margot Lee Shetterly, The Tiger Balls falls within a genre that has enduring and long-lasting appeal to a wide-reaching audience. I was born into a family of collegiate athletes. Some of my earliest memories are crawling around my father's legs in concrete stadiums, sticky with spilled soda and popcorn. My grandfather coached track at Vanderbilt at the same time as the Tiger Balls rise to fame. He and their coach, Edward Temple, became friends, drawn together by their mutual love of the sport. My early awe of the Tiger Balls grew as I watched their legacy bloom and women's sports flourish. I earned a degree in art history that taught me to dig into the past relentlessly. And once that attention was turned to the Tiger Balls in earnest in 2015, my love for their story rose with each new discovery. In addition to over 5,000 hours of personal research, including interviews and access to unpublished materials, I've had the support of several members of the TSU coaching staff and community, published scholars and Nashville sports historians, and influential members of the community who are eager for the story to be shared. I'm also a nonfiction editor for Pangaris Literary Magazine and am a member of the Historical Writers Association, the Grub Street and Catapult Communities, and the WNBA Boston chapter. I anticipate the final manuscript length to be approximately 80,000 words and have a complete proposal, including two sample chapters ready to share. I hope you fall in love with the Tiger Balls like I have.
Oh my goodness. There are so many things I love that you did there. You know, even if you don't have the 10 billion people following you on social media, you have shown how you are the person to write this book. And there are so many different ways to establish authority. And for you, it feels almost like it's like access. Like you knew the people, you had the support. 5,000 hours of research. My goodness. Yeah. I loved that. And you did a wonderful thing that I so rarely get to see an example of right before your comps paragraph. Would you read just the last couple lines that are the fun things that they get to do again?
Along their journey to Rome, the women see their friends arrested for protesting with John Lewis in Nashville, have to fight off racist reporters and unfair media, spend evenings dancing to Motown tunes with Cassius Clay, explore the streets of Rome, and reach out their hands for Olympic gold.
See, this to me is, I haven't found a perfect term for it yet, but I like to think of good pitch letters as being like movie trailers, right? And there's usually a moment near the end when there are just these quick flashes of all these amazing things that are going to happen that show us the breadth of the book. You know, give us a bunch of quick images of all of these cool things are going to happen. And it has this effect of speeding it up and giving it a certain momentum. And you did that beautifully. So when we come up with a title for whatever we are talking about there, that is a wonderful example of that.
Yeah. Oh, and that's exactly what caught my eye. It just sparked my imagination. It made me actually picture the girls there with Cassius Clay, you know, and said, this is going to be a great episode.
I really wanted to show that it wasn't all, I mean, the struggle was so important to what they did, but it was a lot of fun too. They had a lot of fun. They have a lot of really wonderful stories. And it kind of reminds me of a Walt Disney quote that I think is kind of wonderful and horrible at the same time, where he said, before I can make you laugh, I have to make you cry. And so it's kind of like you have to be able to really empathize with someone before you feel their ultimate joy. And you're also even feeling their struggle a little bit more because you love them, because they are so lovable as humans. They're actually wonderful people that I can't wait for more people in the world to get to meet.
What are they doing now?
So most of them are retired because they're in their 80s. Actually, all of them are retired. The ones who are still with us are, you know, spending time with their families. They don't love to do a lot of public things, but they, through their lives universally, and this is one of the most incredible things that you can take away from what they learned being a part of a team, they all focused on giving back to their communities. Every single one of them was a teacher, was a coach, was a community leader, really did amazing things for their community, were just celebrated in their own communities, not because of what they accomplished in that one summer, but what they accomplished over their lives and what they gave back to the people that came behind them. I mean, it was the ultimate example of reaching your hand back and pulling up the people that came behind you. Every single one of them, to a person, they had that expectation for themselves and they all fulfilled it. Really just an incredible group of women.
That's really beautiful.
Too. Yeah.
And I love how you mentioned that even though society at large was not yet in a place of supporting them, their local community was. And I think that's such a beautiful thing that, you know, even if we can't get the world on the same page, I bet just knowing helps people be compassionate, be the best version of themselves, help out someone they know, support people. Let, you know, I imagine everyone was happy to be like, yes, please, Olympic team, use our track. I hope that was the case. Do you know of any more anecdotes like that?
Yeah. So, well, it was a little more challenging because, like I was saying, that because of the civil rights protests that were taking part in Nashville at the time, and the track that they were offered to use was Vanderbilt, and Vanderbilt wasn't, the SEC sports and the whole Southeastern Conference weren't integrated at that time. So it was even controversial for that to happen. But Jim Lawson was one of the people leading the protests in Nashville, started in February in 1960, the same year that they were going to Rome. They started the sit-ins in Nashville. That was the first time that they started doing protests. So they had to choose between whether they could participate in these protests or if they got in trouble, arrested, any kind of citations, they would lose their athletic eligibility. So I think they all kind of universally talk about that too. But a challenge that was to decide the way that they were going to try to support the movement. For them, it was about showing their excellence to the world. But it was really painful for them not to be able to participate with their students and to also see the real challenges that their students were going through. So even being able to use it to track at that time was pretty controversial. But then once they got to Europe, they didn't have all of the same issues that they had in the US and particularly in the South. And so that showed them another way to be and that there was another life that was possible for them. It showed the rest of the United States that people were worthy of being elevated.
It's so frustrating that often in cases like these, it's be perfect or bust. You know, one little mistake and they won't let them do this incredible thing they're capable of.
Yeah. And their coach was notoriously strict on them, but he knew that they had no margin for error. One fun anecdote was, I mean, it's fine, but at the time it was really challenging. One of the women that was trained by the coach who ended up running for the Olympic team actually got kicked out of school before. So she qualified from a different team because she was riding in a car with a boy. That's how she got kicked off the team because his rules, and he hated to do it. It was one of his prize runners that he had to maintain these rules. And if anybody started breaking the rules, then they all would think that they were able to. And one superstar wasn't treated any different from anyone on the team. And he had to maintain these rules for them because they had no margin for error. They had to be taken seriously. They couldn't have anybody else, you know, putting them down for any other reason. They didn't have that flexibility or they didn't have that privilege, I guess.
Yeah, they were being scrutinized for everything. Yeah. You know, everybody knows the name Wilma Rudolph. Most people do, right? But what I like about this book is that people don't realize that she had a whole team with her. And for the first time, some of these other ladies are going to get to be in the limelight. We don't know the stories of these other ladies, you know? So that's what I liked about Amy's approach is that she could have just chose to feature Wilma because everybody knows Wilma. but she saw that the other ladies also were remarkable women. All of them were ahead of their time, and it's time for the world to know, to meet the other women.
You often will hear about that one, you know, kind of spectacular sports talent that, you know, defies all the odds and makes it to an elite level on their own. But what was unique about the Tiger Bells is it wasn't just about their individual talent. It was the way that they worked together that made each other better. And Wilma Rudolph would be the first to tell you that she would not have gotten where she was without her teammates pushing her. She won 3 gold medals herself in the 1960 Olympics, but she was kind of famously lazy. She would have to get dragged out to practice in the morning, and she ate junk food, and she would get distracted, and, you know, she'd show up late to practice, you know, or things like that. She had all of these sisters around her that mentored her and wouldn't let her get away with the kinds of things that she wanted to. And she had Mae Fags was in the Olympics in 1948 and 1952. And she brought Wilma in and told her, you can't do that. You can't be goofing around. You have to, you know, stay focused and stay on my shoulder. There's a great story about Wilma Rudolph, but she was only 16. And Mae Fags had made it into her first Olympics when she was 16 too. And she knew that Wilma had the talent to be able to make it, but she was just getting in her own way because she was nervous. And she said, Wilma, do you want to make the Olympic team? And Wilma said, of course, I want to make it. And she said, you stay on my shoulder. And so she ran the race literally on her shoulder the whole time. And they made the Olympic team together. And the funniest thing was the coach described when they came around the corner of the 220 that Wilma was gaining on Mae Fags. And Mae had to pull, she said she dug way deep to find that extra. She had to beat Wilma. And then she turned around as soon as they passed the finish line with Mae Fags first and Wilma Rudolph second. And she just wheeled on her and said, I didn't tell you to beat me. I said, stay on my shoulder. So it was that like kind of combination of like them pushing each other to be better, but also helping each other. You know, like they had a really pretty intense competition, but that real deep love and support for each other. So it's kind of a combination of those things carry all the way through. And Barbara Jones was the diva on the team. And she also had gone to the Olympics and won a gold medal when she was just 15. And when she got on the Tiger Bells team, she came in and she had already, you know, reached some fame. And she said, there was no room on the Tiger Bells for divas. There was no diva behavior. We were all divas. And so there was no room for anybody to be a superstar. She had to learn that lesson really quick. She couldn't be a diva anymore. But I love that she said, well, I was diva, but we were all divas.
I wish it wasn't so rare to hear stories of women really succeeding at difficult things and supporting each other.
Right. Yeah, it's true. It's something that we should all, you know, work for in our day. I mean, and publishing is this kind of intense industry as well. I always think about that, you know, with other writing friends that I work with, that we are excited for each other. You know, one person succeeding doesn't mean that somebody else is not going to succeed. We cheer for each other's successes. You know, one of my writing partners just published an essay online and, you know, in Cognoscenti, which in Boston is, you know, everybody wants to be in Cognoscenti. And that was the hugest celebration too. We promote each other and we all can succeed together. We can also really support and love each other for our successes.
That's beautiful. Are the women still friends and in touch?
Oh, yeah. They stayed close and they come back to school for all of the major events, and they definitely stayed close throughout their lives. For example, when Coach Temple, their coach, passed away, they all were there at the funeral and they were all sitting right up front, all the Tiger Bells all together. When one of them would make a Hall of Fame, they would all show up. When one of them would, you know, get recognized for their job, you know, maybe retired after 35 years of teaching, they would all show up for that. They are a real family. It's really inspiring to see. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about how their success led to Title IX?
So the direct line is a little tricky, but So David Marinus wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book about the 1960 Olympics, just the whole Olympics, not just the Tiger Bells, but he featured the Tiger Bells, and such a well-known, you know, historian was the first one that I've heard just say it outright that without the Tiger Bells, that it's hard to imagine how Title IX would have happened, because they were the first people, the first women that were able to show that they could compete with the men. In 1958, it was 2 years before the Rome Olympics, and the Tiger Bells were just starting to gain more national attention. And they all won the national championship together. And so the coach got selected. It was the first Black coach that had been selected as the national team. And they didn't want the women to represent the country, because this was during the Cold War in 1958 between the U.S. and Russia. And when the Russia propaganda, you know, whenever they were talking about the U.S. and they were saying these problems in the U.S., it's kind of what they're doing now. They take the seeds of the truth and then they exaggerate it. And so they say there are all these racial tensions in the U.S. and that's why it's bad. And they say they don't recognize the women in their sports, and that's why, you know, communism is better and, you know, the United States is bad. But these were true facts. And so the U.S., in order to kind of counteract some of the messaging that was coming out of Russia, they were kind of forced to include the women, but they were also afraid to include the women because they really didn't believe they were going to be able to compete against the Russians. And so they thought that was going to be even more embarrassing. But because the Tiger Bells had shown such dominating success, they just gave them a shot. The White House ultimately made the call because it was a political decision. They said, look, you know, they show that we're supporting people, you know, despite the racial tension, and, you know, we're supporting our women. And so they let them go kind of reluctantly, and they ended up beating the Russian team. And so it took that, it took those successes and that, you know, fighting everybody thinking they weren't going to do what they said they could do. And it took all of that to realize that instead of only the men being the asset for the U.S., that the women were assets too. That win that they had against Russia in 1958 was great for the country. They were realizing that the women could actually be an asset in ways that they hadn't considered before. And so realizing that women athletes were actually an advantage and not something to be discouraged, it took a while, but I think that was what eventually led, you know, it was pretty widely known that after 1958, and especially after 1960, that was the first televised Olympics too. And so women were allowed to see other women running and performing for the first time they had ever, and especially people of color had never seen people on TV that looked like them before. And so this was a chance for people to actually see, I can run, even though in my community, they're saying it's bad for me and I can't. And so that's when track programs started kind of exploding all over the country. And when there's the demand, you have to meet the demand. And so it just kind of started the ball rolling to Title IX. And Title IX didn't actually take effect until the late 70s. So it was really a long fight for them to get that kind of equity in sports.
But it would have been a lot longer.
It would have been a lot longer without them. Absolutely. Yeah. They provided a template for other programs to follow. And, you know, when you have people saying, I want to be a Tiger Bell, then they need to have a high school program. And so high school programs were started, and then middle school programs were started. There's a kind of terrible also article from the New York Times. It came out kind of in coinciding with the Olympics, where it said Venus is not a shot putter. And it was talking about the feminine ideal and this was in the New York Times. And it was all about how sports really, well, I mean, maybe you could play tennis or swim, that's attractive, but Venus is not a shot putter. And so it was it was all, you know, talking about how women in sports was unattractive, but
wow.
Changing that narrative and showing how women being strong and successful is actually a benefit to the country was something that the Tiger Bell started, and it took all the people coming behind them to make it happen too.
I wonder if the fact that article existed was proof that the status quo was scared.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the same today, where the easiest way to keep what you have is to try to keep your own privilege, is to try to keep other people from getting it. But it just doesn't work. And we've seen that time and time again, like forward progress is going to happen anyway.
I love the idea of girls across the country saying they wanted to be a Tiger Bell.
Yeah, I have a funny story. I think I put this in a proposal, to show where I come from a family of athletes and I was not athletic. I grew up in the 70s and, you know, there are four children in my family. And when your siblings are participating in something over the summer, you have to do it too, whether you want to or not, whether it's your thing or not. So one summer, my older brother and sister were running at a track club and I had to do it too. And I didn't like running, especially in the hot summer in Tennessee. But somehow one day we went to a meet and I came in third place and I got a yellow ribbon. But I think there were only like five kids running. But my dad said, "Amy, you were so good. You looked like a Tiger Bell." And aww. I thought that was the greatest praise. I knew I didn't deserve it at that time, but it was like the highest praise for me. So I grew up thinking of the Tiger Bells as just the standard in athletics. And so I think a lot of other people did, but you know, I grew up in the 70s and that was a long time ago, and Tennessee, where they were from. And so I would be more likely to hear about them. But it'd be nice for more people to have the Tiger Bells as that standard that they really deserve to be.
I think as a culture, we underestimate and undervalue the enthusiasm of young women and the things they're enthusiastic about. And I bet there are a lot of young women who look back on that and think, you know, of all the excitement they had envisioning their life perhaps being similar, or the excitement they had of seeing young women like them succeed so well.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine something is possible until you see it for the first time. And that's why I think that Olympics being televised really changed things, because people were able to see not just the people who didn't think that women could do this. They saw how they could and how incredible it was to see, you know, these women who were collegiate athletes were running against some of the countries where they were basically state-sponsored athletes, where they didn't have to worry about being also a student. All they were doing was just focusing on their sport all the time, and how they could succeed and they could win even against those kind of, to see that. So the detractors were able to witness it with their own eyes, but also, like you said, the young women were able to see that's possible. And a lot of people had said that, people that I interviewed said, I never thought that I could run until I saw somebody else do that. And actually, one of the things that made me really want to write this story to begin with was to actually like dive in and go full tilt on the story with my aunt. She grew up in Nashville on campus with my grandfather, and he was the track coach at Vanderbilt. And there was no women's track team at Vanderbilt. The women weren't encouraged to run. And she was super active, and she was, you know, always coming in with skinny knees and her hair messed up and kind of being told to behave like a young lady. And she saw the Tiger Bells come run on the Vanderbilt campus, and she said, "I've never seen anything more powerful than that." And even just when I talked to her, and she was in her late 70s, and she said that was the thing that she remembered almost most about her childhood, and that seeing them do that made her believe that she could run and play outside with the boys. You know, and my dad at the time was on the track team, and she thought she couldn't do that. You know, she thought that wasn't available to her until she saw the Tiger Bells run.
That's beautiful. Well, here's to much more proof that people can do amazing things and inspire others to do the same. And I imagine you've inspired other writers today, too.
I hope so. I hope so. I want to read all the stories.
And I will just briefly note, I'm sure there are some people out there who are not sports fans, but still found themselves riveted by the stories that you're telling. And I think that is testament to the power of story, the power of pitching narratively versus, you know, here are the characters, here's how they feel about everything versus here's this world, here are some facts. And showing that ultimately we connect to each other's stories that way. And, you know, pitching sci-fi, you don't pitch, here are the physics of the world, you pitch, here is this story. And I think that's a really powerful thing to think about. So if there are any others out there like me who don't understand sports, but loved this conversation, yeah. I think that's a really powerful, powerful example of that.
It's a human interest story above all. I think it transcends sports. I mean, the ones that are into sports will have that extra appreciation. But overall, I see it first and foremost as a human interest story, a group of remarkable women.
Kind of like how a lot of us say that we want stories that are officially about one thing, but actually about so much more.
What is your number one tip for writers, for both of you?
I think that the thing that I learned through this process is not to be afraid to pivot. You have to listen to feedback, and you have the story in your own head, and it's amazing. But getting the story in your head out in a way that's going to be received and the way that you intend for it to be received takes a lot of work. And I feel like every time that something wasn't working quite right, you know, when I went back and worked on crafts or I got feedback from other people, that's where I got better. And that's how I was able to articulate really what I was trying to get across in a more effective way. And so that, I think that's the thing I learned the most through this. When you're getting negative feedback, that's the time to stop and pause and think about how to restructure or how to rework, because it doesn't mean that it's not going to ever happen. It just means maybe just a little pivot, just a little adjustment, and, you know, and focus on how you can make it better. That's what I would say. And not to ever stop writing.
Yeah, for those writers who feel like they have this story that's burning inside them, and they keep saying, I have this story, I have this story inside me. Well, the thing is, get it out of your system. Get the story written. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect the first time around. Just be proactive about it. And I know that's, you know, easier said than done, because we all are so busy. There's so many distractions in our daily lives. But my advice is, don't procrastinate anymore. Just even if you write a few words a day, just be proactive. And then for those writers who maybe have already gotten the story out of their system, right, and they've written it, the next part is for them to summon up the courage to show it to someone, to show it to that. That's the hard part, is you've written something, but you're just afraid that it's not good enough. It takes a lot of courage for a writer to show a piece of their work to somebody else. If you're going to do that, maybe sometimes it's better to show it to a fellow writer, somebody else who also writes, because I feel like all writers, you know, they have kind of the same psyche. It takes a real writer to know another writer. And so have the courage to show your work, because it takes a lot of courage. It took a lot of courage for Amy to show the first draft of her proposal to somebody, right? It took her courage to start querying agents, right? And then so courage is a large part of this process, is both the writer has to have the courage, the agent has to have the courage, the editor has to have the courage to advocate for it before an editorial board. Everybody needs courage. So have courage.
This was awesome. I can't wait for this book. Like, I'm so excited. And I, you know, nice meeting you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for wanting to feature Amy and I. And Amy, thank you so much for writing such a remarkable book that was relatively easy to sell. I wish all of them were like yours, Amy. So I really, you know, thank you for that as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for letting us talk. Letitia, thanks so much for giving me a chance.
How could I not? What was not to love?
Oh, that's beautiful. All right. Wishing you both much success, and can't wait to see what happens next for you.
All right. Have a wonderful day. Enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.
We are so glad that you joined us. And as always, we appreciate your feedback. Just head on over to the iTunes store and let us know what you think. It not only helps us make this podcast be the best it can be, but it also affects our ratings within the iTunes platform.
We'd love to hear from you. If you're feeling brave and want to submit your page for our First Pages podcast, you can send it to academy@manuscriptwishlist.com with First Pages Podcast in the subject line. We'd also just love to hear from you.
And if you'd like to learn more about the Manuscript Academy and everything we have to offer,